Well, it's game time, you know. It's like walking in down the ramp into the lights of a concert hall, and you're about to perform, or a stadium where you're about to play. It's our cathedral, it's our stadium, it's our court, it's our home field. Walk into the sliding doors, it's game time, and that's how I approach it.
Welcome to the Heroic Minds Podcast, where we discover how to get out of our own way, unleash the full capability of our mind, become the hero of our story, and a hero for other people.
From an evolutionary perspective, we've evolved to manage threatening encounters.
I want to do everything in my ability to help them, but they make the call.
We have to do it in a way that doesn't just assume that going faster is going to be the cure-all.
When you suffer and then you come out of it on the other side, you stand a little taller, your voice doesn't shake anymore, your eyes are always up.
Sorry to depress you guys. Self-doubt is par for the course. It's just how you choose to deal with them, react to them or not react to them.
A little tough love goes a long way, and high expectation also goes a long way. The more you expect of someone, the more they'll do.
I have to keep moving forward. No good comes from going back.
I don't need red tape. I'm not into rules. I'm not into regulation. I'm just going to do this.
Welcome back to the Heroic Minds Podcast. On today's episode, we have Dr. John Buchvar. I am sure many of you recognize the name Dr. Buchvar from the incredible Netflix documentary Lenox Hill, where the viewer gets a dive into the lives of four doctors as they navigate the highs and lows of working at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York City. Dr. Buchvar has a long, long list of credentials in both leadership roles and academics that I unfortunately had to cut short for the sake of this intro. Dr. Buchvar is the vice chair of the Department of Neurosurgery and the director of the Brain Tumor Center at Lenox Hill Hospital in Manhattan. He is also a professor of neurological surgery at the Zucker School of Medicine and an investigator at the Feinstein Institute for Medical Research, where he directs the Laboratory for Brain Tumor Biology and Therapy. I encourage you to watch the show Lenox Hill because it is everything we talk about in this podcast. Rolling out in front of your eyes without the science, without the complexity, just raw humanity in its most courageous and resilient form. In this episode, we travel all over the place, from Michael Jordan to Tom Petty, to why you should never let the holes in the Swiss cheese align, how high performance really starts with a mindful minute. We even touch on how throwing tennis balls randomly at your kids to catch is an innovative life lesson. All that and lots more packed into this incredible Heroic Minds episode. But as always, before we hop into this incredible discussion, we have to give a shout out to our amazing friends over at True Local. TRULOCAL.ca is the website if you want to check them out. True Local, what is it? It is high quality meat, individually packaged, well, locally sourced first, individually packaged. You decide exactly what kind of meat you want, when you want it to show up, and that individually packaged, locally sourced, high-quality meat shows up to your doorstep on dry ice in a beautiful black box with a big logo that says True Local. And then the best part is that there's no hidden fees. If you want it to come 2 months later, have it come 2 months later. If you want it to come 2 weeks later, have it come 2 weeks later. You decide when the box shows up. You decide what is in the box. And everything is frozen, so you can throw it right in your freezer and pull it out whenever you want. And they are now offering frozen fruit and frozen veggies as well. So they are starting to increase their offering that is already amazing. And by the way, their packaging is also recyclable. If you want to give them a try, use the discount code HEROICMINDS25 to get $25 off a regular size box and $10 off a personal size box. All right, here we go. Is a quote you had in the show, and this is where I want to start things off, is you said you don't dare to imagine what you're going to encounter when you go to work. Could you unpack that and why is that?
Well, as you know, and this goes for any job, and of course, we have sliding door moments throughout our entire lives, as we like to say, whether you catch that subway or miss that six train can obviously impact your life. And you know, we call those sliding door moments. And the same thing happens in healthcare and medicine, and particularly neurosurgery, where the stakes are so high. And, you know, we've gotten, at least I've gotten used to understanding that what we expect to happen on a given day is unlikely to happen, and vice versa. And that leads us to obviously develop coping strategies for those inconsistencies. And I don't dare to imagine, in fact, today I have, you know, so many sliding door moments for so many patients. And my job, as we say in our business, is we want to make sure that the holes in the Swiss cheese never align, because that's how mistakes happen. And we want to have multiple layers in that Swiss cheese to make sure mistakes don't happen. And, you know, it's just so exciting every day to, as you say, unpack these challenges.
It makes me think that that changes your preparation. We're at a time where, and I've seen this in sport, is that there's a hyper focus on what we think is going to happen and variables that are, that we assume are going to occur. But it seems like you can't take that approach.
Well, yes and no. And, you know, I was an athlete like you, and I think practiced what we call deliberate practice and grit. And I always tell my kids, and I got four kids, and I always tell them, you know, effort's more important than talent. And developing muscle memory, and there's a great book called The Science of Peak Performance by Erickson, where really he dials into how deliberate practice and how muscle memory and how mental representations ahead of the event help you prepare for the event itself. So Michael Jordan used to, when he would, you know, put down 63 points in, you know, two quarters, he was developing those mental representations of the ball going through the hoop. And I teach our surgeons, and I've developed these techniques over the years, that I need to develop the mental representation of, okay, what's going to happen when I do the next move in surgery? Is the aneurysm going to rupture, or is the brain tumor going to have a vein behind it? And so there is muscle memory that we have to develop in surgical technique. But on the day-to-day, and I'm going to give a lot of athletic references because that's what I do, you know the saying, move without the ball, right? And so it's not just the times that you're in surgery that are important. It's the times when you don't have the ball. And I tell my staff and my residents and even my kids, learn to move without the ball. That's an important way to get through life, an important way for us to get through the day. Just as an example, what do I mean by that? Yesterday, I had to go up and take my patient who was my next surgical patient. I went up instead of waiting for patient transport to go get my patient and bring him to surgery. You know, that's one example of moving without the ball, where you know, yesterday I went up and I took this patient down, and it improves the safety for our patients.
I love that approach. Again, it takes it, it almost seems like it takes the stress off the execution of things perfectly. Now that's, I guess, leads to another question is perfection, it seems like it would be an assumption that in brain surgery, it has to be perfection. Is that approach, is that something you strive for?
Well, as my wife likes to say, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to be a neurosurgeon. You know, the answer is yes and no. Obviously, we strive to be perfect, right? But the enemy of you know, excellent is perfect. So in a way, you want to make sure that you're not, the hardest part about being a surgeon is knowing when to quit, right? You know, you can say, well, maybe I should take out a little bit more tumor, or maybe I can do this a little bit more perfectly, leave a lead in the brain that's going to, you know, and the root of that is what? You'd harm. And so actually making sure that you're not striving sometimes for that last perfect move can be the difference when you're doing something that can cause some harm. So it's a little bit of a tricky balance. And again, you see it in sport also, knowing exactly if you have, you know, a breakaway on a goaltender on with the puck, you know, you may do that extra move and the puck's going to slip off your stick and you've ruined your chance. So when do you put the goal, you know, the puck in the, you know, behind the goalie?
It's not that I had many breakaways, but I wish I knew that back in the day when I was playing. I told you I'm going to hop back and forth, you know, philosophy, leadership. And one thing that stood out in the show was that you were also human, even though the common theme or common narrative is that, you know, doctors are, and I put it in quotations, desensitized to death and tragedy. But I don't know if that's the word. What word would you use? How would you describe that?
Well, you know, it's a delicate balance. You don't want to get too close, you know, to the humanity, but everything we do is, you know, as David Langer says in the show, is for the humanity of it. And I think it takes a really, you know, special training and obviously a special individual to know where to, you know, meet in between that. I have had surgeons who've come up to me after the show and have told me, I can't do what you do. I can't develop that relationship with my patients. It will overtake me. And that's okay too. I think everyone has their balance. The way that I think all of us on the show, we tend to be okay with letting the emotional aspect of our work guide us because we're empathetic. And I treat every patient like they were my twin brother or my sister or my wife or daughter, for example. But I know how to turn it on a dime where I can basically say, all right, the drapes are on. We are laser focused. And again, that's where mental representation and muscle memory take over. So you have to sort of be able to make that switch where you go from empathetic, emotional, humane caregiver to laser focused. I'm a robot. Let's get this job done as fast as possible.
The show does such a great job of showing exactly that. And I'm so obsessed, I guess you could say, with people now and watching behaviors. And I watched the show, you and your coworkers do exactly what you just said. And I think there's so much value in that ability to turn it on and turn it off. Again, I look at the common narratives around today that say, you know, you have to be disciplined at all times in your life and you have to be stoic at all times. And if you don't live your whole life that way, then you won't be successful. Well, it's proof that you're able to turn, you have to be adaptable and change for different environments. Can we dive into that further of was there a time at the beginning of your career where maybe you weren't able to switch into that execution mode?
You know, I don't remember a time in my career where I wasn't. And again, obviously, as you mature, whether you're a concert pianist or a Wall Street banker or a surgeon for that matter, obviously, experience does come with some age, but I've always remembered being, even when I was a resident, even as a medical student, the patients, you know, I just was so involved in the emotional component of disease and injury that I don't remember ever having a time where I wasn't. I also was a neuropsychopharmacology major at Penn. And so like you, I have a psychology interest. And I think that foundation has instilled in me a certain understanding of the basic neuropharmacology and psychopharmacology of, you know, the disease. You're right, when the expectation is everyone's got to be, you know, on in today's society or, you know, living their hero moment. And the truth is that's not true. And we know that, particularly in a time like 2020, where you wake up in the morning and it, to me, you know, breaking news now is enough to make your heart skip. And, you know, our emails every morning and our texts and Snapchats and whatever it is, TikTok, you know, there's enough information to make a really imbalanced.
Well, I think one part of the show, and it's in the trailer actually for the show, that I think really pulls people in, but I think there's so much to unpack there. And it's the moment, the mindful moment before beginning a surgery as a group, as a team. What does that do for you? Where did that start? Has that always been a part of something you do with your teams?
The mindful moment came from the practice of mindfulness, which is your own mindfulness practices, taking time, particularly during the day where you focus on your breathing. It could be 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 15 minutes, 40 minutes. And obviously this is not a new technique of meditation. And what it does is it brings you into the present moment, and your job is to not judge the thoughts that are coming into your head and to sort of see them and let them go, coming back and centering yourself in the present moment, which is your breathing. So I said, you know what, we spend so much surgical timeouts where we're checking the patient and the identity and the bracelets and the medications and the equipment. What about checking in on each other and checking in on ourselves and make it a moment where, hey, let's check in to the surgeon. Let's check in to the nurse anesthetist. Let's check in with the scrub technician. And I started a mindful moment, and it is just so nice to do. And that time when you're with the team, you know, it's sort of the national anthem in sport when you just close your eyes and take a moment. And that's our national anthem before the puck drops.
That is so cool. It's so powerful. And you can see that in the show too, which I think is such a lesson for others that, you know, again, relating this to the other people's lives and their jobs is roll into the office, roll out of bed and jump right into work. Cause you have to, if you're not working hard, you're not going to be successful. And it's kind of, wait a second, let's have that anthem. Right. I think that's, I love that. Continuing on this concept of leadership in the operating room, what is your approach to that? Like from an outside view, I had no idea there were that many people involved in the operating room. In my mind, I saw three surgeons or three people. It looks like there's 10, 15 people at times. And I wondered, how do you run a system like that and choreograph, I guess you could say, to make sure everything is so smooth and no one was running into each other, et cetera? Where does that stem from?
Well, I think, you know, I approach it much like flying an airplane, which I don't know how to do, but there are a lot of people in the operating room, and we run much, you know, we're pilots on the airplane, but we're also in charge of the entire airplane. You know, we do the steering of the plane, we do the surgery, but we have to make sure that the entire team, the entire flight is safe and ready. And there are a lot of people who we rely on. And in fact, our team approach is key to the success of the entire surgery. So we have scrub technicians who are terrific. We have nurses, we have rotating nurses, we have circulating nurses, we have anesthesiologists, we have nurse anesthetists, we have residents, fellows, sometimes med students. So again, it's that Swiss cheese approach where we want to make sure there are multiple slices that prevent those holes from aligning, and making sure that, you know, safety first in the operating room.
I usually don't add my two cents to these episodes. I like to let them roll out naturally, but I did want to interject here to encourage you to watch Lenox Hill for the leadership that takes place in the operating room, because it is absolutely outstanding. At times you forget who's in charge as you're watching the scenes play out. And when I say scenes, I mean the reality that's happening. It's not actors, it's real life. And there's a certain sense of belonging that every single person has, value, responsibility, and that can be so incredibly empowering. If you look at Tony Robbins' 6 core human needs, or even Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which I think everyone learns in school, they are both built around this idea of belonging, connection, even more importantly, contribution. When you feel like you're contributing to something, you're part of something bigger than yourself, can be so incredibly empowering. There is no hierarchy in these operating rooms where you can see someone being more valued than someone else, that, hey, we can get this job done without you. Your role is important, but not that important. There's none of that. Everyone is there. Everyone has a role. Everyone is empowered by that understanding. I think furthermore, it makes for a more resilient team, because it's not the approach that if our main leader hasn't shown up today, whether physically or performance-wise, things aren't going to go well. With this approach, there's no room for that. If someone goes down, that's fine. That's why we have all these other members that are extremely valuable to this team. And someone in that room or a group of people then work to bring that person up or take over for their temporary lack of performance. And that is okay. That is a sustainable approach to group or team resilience. And it starts with the approach to leadership.
With all that going on, you also have this very, very, very small room for error. You have all these people. You do your mindful moment to bring people in and ground them before you go into execution mode. Are you constantly aware that it is a human being you're working on? You do this so often. Does that sometimes, you lose sight that, hey, this is a human being? Or I wonder when you show up to work and you do this so often, not the desensitization approach, but is there a point where you have to kind of remind yourself?
Well, the answer is yes. You can, you know, there's a theory of psychology called, you know, catastrophizing, right? So if things are not going your way and all of a sudden you start catastrophizing, my gosh, the aneurysm is bleeding, or I can't get a whole control of the bleeding. And this is a mother of three and she's 45. And if she dies, God forbid, then this is going to be terrible. And my reputation, I mean, you can go down and all of us can catastrophize at any moment of time. And part of that is understanding that's a normal human process. And how do you avoid catastrophizing in all aspects of life? One of the techniques that I think is invaluable is making sure that you have a partner nearby that you can always count on to help you, you know, steady yourself. And I think what surgeons don't recognize is that it's okay to reach the point where it's, hey, could you call in a reinforcement for me and just get a fresh set of eyes in here? I just need to have that reassurance. And we tell everybody that there shouldn't be a day where there's not a neurosurgeon that can come in, you know, literally put their hands on your shoulder, sit down under the microscope and steady the plane.
I like that. Again, it kind of contradicts the, you know, if you're not able to do it yourself, then you're not going to be successful. You're not going to be the hero, which we already briefly unpacked. I think that's so powerful. In the show, there are a lot of powerful moments where you're delivering negative news to people. And I'm sure you get questions like this all the time, your approach to that. Now, I think it goes without saying, and you look at Twitter, the world loves you as a person and your team because of everything you do and the human side you have, the altruism you have. You seem to be very optimistic. Now, what is your belief on that line of false hope versus optimism in the field that you're in, also knowing the statistics that exist?
I think it's a great question. One that I, you know, I always have, I'm a straight shooter. And so I will be very upfront when I, God forbid, have to give a family a diagnosis of brain cancer. I will look them in the eye and say, look, here's what I will tell you. I'll treat you like I would want to be treated. I will treat you like the science has proven. We're not anecdotal. We're evidence-based. I won't sugarcoat any bad news, but I'm going to try my darndest to give you the best quality of life and the longest life possible with that quality. So it takes, you know, developing that relationship. There are obviously moments of trauma you know, devastation, or we have to give bad news very urgently or quickly. But as you develop a relationship with the family, I think they understand that I'm going to tell it like it is. I am an eternal optimist. There's no doubt about that. But I will never give false hope, and I'll never sugarcoat anything. But I will say, if, for example, an MRI shows progression of a brain cancer where it's getting worse, I'll say, look, tumor's growing. We understand that this is part of the natural history of this disease. And that is something that we now have to face. And we're going to have these three treatment options to tackle this. If this doesn't work, then we may be having a difficult discussion. And so some of it is also laying the groundwork of anticipatory guidance as we move forward in the battle against some of these diseases.
It's incredible because the way you just delivered that made something that seems like you have no control over it give someone a bit of that control. Here's what we know, and we're going to act on what we do know. And I wonder if that's part of the reason that it's such a good, you probably know this already, but that's probably why it works so well in such an unfortunate circumstance.
Well, here's what I say to every patient when I meet them. I say, I'm going to tell you what I know, what I don't know, and what I think. And you know, we quote dumb it down a little bit because as doctors, we're not good at dumbing things down, and we're not good at saying, you know, and God, you know, look, we're all on the other side of the desk at some point, right? We're all patients. There, you know, my wife had a procedure, actually in some of the footage that wasn't aired for the show. And so we're all sitting on the other side of a doctor's desk at some point in our lives. And so my expectation is that The doctor's going to be forthright. The doctor's going to be firm. The doctor's going to be knowledgeable. The doctor's going to be compassionate and empathetic. And the doctor is going to make a decision that I would expect him or her to have done for their own family member.
Again, I do not usually add these voiceovers, but again, John and his team just continues to blow me away. And what he just said is, in a very simple approach, the hero's journey. It is how the hero decides to act in a negative circumstance, in any circumstance. And it's three simple steps that not only the doctors in the show and not only the patients, but the patients' families, all of them take this same approach. And it's something that we can all apply to our lives. If we look at so many of the victim narratives today, these self-imposed narratives that we decide to use that are extremely deflating, it needs to change. It really does. And a great call to action is this show. And so the three steps are quite simple. One is they recognize that the world can be dark, the world can be unfair, and the world can be scary. Now, they don't run from that or deny it. They simply recognize that. Number two is believe. So you have recognize and then believe. They decide to believe that there is something they can do to improve the given circumstance. They do not believe that they can solve everything at once, but they can act somehow to improve the situation. At first, they may not even know what that is going to be, but they believe there is something. They decide to believe there is something in their control, in their power that they can do. So we have recognize, then you decide to believe, and then you act. Number three is act. They act, they start to get creative. They decide to act in a way or multiple ways to improve the given situation. Now, in relation to Lenox Hill, you can see that they act with science and faith that what they're going to do will improve the situation. Now, think about a hero in your life. Someone that has done something courageous, someone that has been resilient. Likely they followed these same three steps. They recognized, they decided to believe either way, and then finally they decided to act.
In all this, and diving into a bit of the philosophy side, are you a spiritual person?
Am I a spiritual person? I think yes and no. You know, I'm not an overly religious person, and I believe in faith. I believe in family. Spiritual, that's not a question I've actually thought much about. But, you know, I think I am. I think I'm spiritual in that way. But it's, you know, it's a balance of you know, science versus, you know, the spiritual side of things. And, you know, I had a discussion with a mom yesterday, and I turned to her. I said, now it's time to pray and, you know, let nature take its course. So there's a balance here as we deal with, you know, terrible diseases that we draw on both the spiritual side of things and the scientific side of things.
Right. Yeah, see, I feel like there's a point where we all have a spiritual side when we can't, I feel like when we can't answer something, we have to turn to the some sort, whether that's religious based of a story or just energy that exists in the world. I mean, sometimes we have no other option.
Oh, absolutely. And it's important. Doctors are also not good at turning to the spiritual side of things at really any point. And also, you know, there's politics. You know, you don't want to offend patients by recommending, you know, turning to a spiritual path when they're relying on you to provide a scientific path. So, you know, there's a balance that sometimes you have to be where, you know, you're wary of as a doctor sometimes.
I never thought of it that way. That's so true. And the reason I ask, of course, with everything else we've already discussed, but further is looking on the philosophical side of you doing awake brain surgeries. You know, here you are another human helping another human, really, if you really break it down, and you're working on the thing that is ultimately giving us this consciousness that even the best philosophers and scientists in the world aren't able to articulate. And I wondered, what has that ever been a thought that you've had where, wait a second, I'm talking to this person, they're using this tool that's giving them the consciousness to talk to me. Like, to me, I don't even know where to go. I don't even know how to ask the question, to be honest, because it is so complex. I wonder if you've ever, you know, thought about that experience.
Well, I think, you know, I turn to students every day in the operating room when the brain is open, and I'm still amazed. You know, I said, have you ever seen the human brain? And most of them say no. And I said, how amazing it. We're literally, and particularly when the patient's awake talking to me. And every single time I ask a patient when I do an awake surgery, what kind of music do you want me to play? And they say, you know, Tom Petty, for example. It's just amazing when we put a speaker under the drape and they're humming the song. Or last week we had a woman who wanted classical music. And I always turn to the person I'm operating with and I say, gosh, it's just incredible what we're doing. We're operating on the human brain. We're listening to music that the patient wants to hear, and we're all singing along. I mean, it's for, you know, for lack of a better word, it's mind boggling.
Totally. I find that whole concept just fascinating. Evolutionary speaking, I guess you could say, in all of what you see, what side of the fence are you on? And you can be blunt with this, please. Are you on the side of people are fragile and live for the moment? And on the other side is kind of like, you know what, we're resilient, so don't stress too much about the survival side. You know, the show makes me think of only the strong will survive. As you watch these patients be delivered with certain news and the willingness to fight, I guess what comes to mind when you bring up only the strong shall survive?
Well, I think people are more resilient than they think. And I think part of what's great about your podcast and your show is giving people the understanding that they can either develop the tools for resiliency. And, you know, we are human beings, we are fallible, but in general, there's a lot of strength and courage that doesn't come out until there's time of distress or despair. And mostly I see patients who are extremely strong and family members who are extremely courageous, and they want to take risk and they want to take on responsibility. So the power of the human spirit and the power of the human resiliency is incredible. And I rarely, if ever, have seen, you know, weakness or, you know, a lack of courage or complacency when it comes to, you know, dealing with illness. And that being said, some patients, for whether religious or spiritual, other reasons, may not choose to go along toward a path of treatment. But gosh, in medicine, there may be no other field where you see that power of the human fortitude better than in what we do.
And you brought up an interesting point with the political side that comes into your job and your role, your expertise. And I question, because we got a glimpse of it in the show, is when people are ready, or I don't like using the term give up, because I don't think that's right. But people are realizing, I don't know if I have enough energy to keep fighting, to keep pushing. How do you fit into that role? Do you feel that you have the right to keep pushing? Or is there a point, you know, because in one of the scenes, you almost seemed like, well, let's not make that decision yet. Let's keep pushing for now and we can figure that out later. But we never saw what happens in there. I wondered what, you know, the truth is and what you feel your role is when someone says, I don't know if I can keep pushing.
Yeah, it is a balance. And again, you can't tell a patient what to do. You can't tell a patient, for example, of end of life. You know, I lost my dad 10 years ago to cancer, and he was pretty specific. He was a doctor as well. He said, you know, John, if they tell me I have terminal illness, just keep me alive for 6 months. Put ESPN on the TV. Even if I'm comatose, just give me a chance to survive for 6 months. God's honest truth. That's what he said. And so in that scene where the gentleman says, you know, I don't know if I want to go on any longer, you obviously respect the wishes. and you allow them the time to digest these decisions. And first of all, I don't do this by myself. We have palliative care experts, we have hospice experts, we have oncopsychologists, we have psychologists in the hospital. So this is a team approach. And in fact, surgeons in general are notoriously bad at discussing end of life. And so it is important to make sure that if these discussions are needed to be had, it's done with professionals who are well-versed at discussing this. But my approach is to give all the options, one of them being no treatment or hospice care or palliative care. Or if I really feel like there's a treatment that is available to the patient that's going to extend quality of life and quantity of life, that they understand the risk benefits of those decisions. And that's all you can do. I've had patients who say, you know what? I'm done. I want, you know, the next 3 months of my life to be not in a hospital and not to have treatment. I understand what it means. I'm going to be with my family, and that's it. And we love and respect those decisions, and we do everything we can to make that patient comfortable and the family comfortable in any way we can.
Now, I have to ask, do you have any anonymous stories of individuals that not necessarily you have convinced, but you've tailored your narrative or your speech to guide someone to, no, let's try something this, or let's try a clinical trial, et cetera. Have you had experiences like that?
Actually, I've had tons of experiences like that. I can give you a personal experience about my aunt. My aunt was diagnosed with salivary duct cancer in a parotid gland. And she went to a very famous cancer hospital here in New York. And they wanted to give her a certain treatment. And she came to me and she said, John, what do you think about this? After she had failed a different treatment, I said, did they ever look for this protein that's on the surface of your cancer cell? And she says, I don't think so. So I got her tumor processed for a certain protein. They found that she had the protein, which was surprising at the time. And she got a drug called Herceptin, which is a monoclonal antibody, which you get intravenously. And it basically has extended her life for years. So there are many examples where I told patients, hey, go down this road, try this, and hoping that it works. It's, you know, evidence-based. There's a scientific rationale behind it. And we pray that it works. And those are the moments that you're really proud of.
Do you have any idea what it is in that conversation that allows them to change their view and maybe open up their mind or be willing to go at it again? Do you know what it is in that? Is it control? Is it information? Do you have any idea what that might be?
My mother introduced me to the term of infantilizing. And infantilizing is when you treat a patient like an infant and you don't allow them to be part of the decision-making, whether it's because you don't think they have the intellectual capabilities to make the right decision, or they're neurocognitively, delayed for what. And it's important never to infantilize a patient. You have to empower the patient and the family to be part of that decision making. And once you show them that respect and give them the arsenal to make the decision, it's empowering. And then they're more likely to make the decision. Empower the patient to make the decision with evidence-based approaches. First of all, they're not going to trust you, and they're not going to make potentially the right decision.
Such an awesome approach. And it spans beyond just healthcare, I think, in supporting people with certain decisions. I think that's fascinating. Now, on the neuroscience side, and I know we touched on clinical trials briefly, I wondered what the approach is to that. How do you decide, hey, yeah, we're going to try this, we're going to go with this, we're not sure? What are usually the statistics like even out of the gates? I guess I'm curious on, again, that was a bit of a taste we got in the show, but what's the approach to that?
Well, look, here's what's great about clinical trials. We know that patients who are enrolled in clinical trials, regardless of what disease it is, whether it's brain cancer, breast cancer, or treatment for blood pressure, patients in clinical trials do better than patients not in clinical trials, even if the patient in the clinical trial is getting a placebo. And there's a whole host of reasons for that. One is that there's something called the placebo effect, which actually works. And then there's something called the Hawthorne effect, which is patients who are being observed do better. And so more psychology in all this. So if you look at all patients, all clinical trials, patients in clinical trials do better than patients not in clinical trials, even if they're getting the non-experimental drug or device. So we encourage patients to understand that before they make a decision. Now, the other thing is we want to make sure there's no incentive financially for any doctor or nurse when they're running a clinical trial, because obviously that would put bias into getting the patients enrolled in a clinical trial. So there should be no financial incentive for me or for any of my staff to enroll a patient. And unfortunately, there's financial incentive in just about everything in healthcare. So your doctor probably gets paid to do your knee arthroscopy. Your oncologist gets paid to give you Herceptin. That's just the way it is. And you have to be frank and understand that there are biases and motives that may be, you know, causing your doctor or surgeon to do something. So that's the idea with clinical trials. We look at evidence-based medicine. First of all, we never do anything that's not safe, but like everything else we do in medicine, there are risks and there's some risk. I run some very risky clinical research trials. And across the nation, we're doing some incredibly risky things to treat brain cancer that include putting poliovirus in the brain, putting Zika virus in the brain, breaking down the blood-brain barrier, using bacterial pathogens to improve immune response. So what can happen with all this? Patients can get sick. But we have safety precautions and paradigms to limit the exposure and the downside risk of these clinical trials. And just we do the best we can to ensure that safety is used.
That's outstanding. Do you have a list of, have there been clinical trials that have been really successful and you've watched them from start to finish? Or is the time span too long to actually visually see that process?
The answer is yes and no. I've seen many, many more clinical trials fail. Remember, about 99% of clinical drugs, you know, fail. Actually, one of the best examples of success, which I've seen over the course of my life, is the treatment of HIV. Right, so HIV in the 80s and early 90s, in quote the Magic Johnson era, was ripping through our cities and our neighborhoods and our hospitals, particularly here in New York City, at a hospital like St. Vincent's Hospital here in New York City. And over the course of two decades, we've seen and some clinical research funded by the National Institutes of Health, we've seen HIV become a chronic disease. It's not cured, but a chronic disease that gives essentially normal life with antiretroviral medication. So to me, that's an example of a disease that potentially was devastating the population. The government and research community came together, really made some important strides, and has changed and altered the treatment of a deadly virus.
Now, it's staying on the topic of success. I'm curious if you have any stories or examples of just how behavior and plasticity, whether it's, you know, neuroanatomy or even just rewiring of the brain. Have you seen some just incredible things that you're not able to explain in your work?
Oh gosh, I mean, where do I begin? Where do I end? Look, I don't know if you were around at the time where two brothers were washing windows in New York City on the 47th floor outside, hanging by one of those window washing platforms. And the rope snapped and one brother fell to his death. And the other one fell and somehow survived a 47-story fall. He fractured and had a significant head injury, and I operated on both his spine and his brain, and he's normal now. Wow. So how do you explain that? So I think he's the longest, the highest surviving fall victim. I have another example of a young boy who went on to a platform in Philadelphia, and he was looking for the subway, and he put his head into the subway, you know, and he turned around and the subway hit him in the head. And he was brought in essentially brain dead. And he had a big hematoma, and we evacuated. He walked out of the hospital.
What?
So, you know, it goes back to our original question. We don't ever dare to imagine what we're going to encounter in a given day. And that gives us hope. That gives us optimism. That gives us a readiness and a preparedness to, be flexible. You know, I was an athlete as a kid, and my kids are all athletic, and we have this thing in our family where I whip a tennis ball at my children all the time because I want them to grab the tennis ball, you know, with left or right hand, forward, backwards. And so we have this game. My wife, is always anxious. We're going to hit the lamps and the chandelier, but even my girls have very good hand-eye coordination. And that's the way I approach going to work every day. You know, which way is the ball going to bounce? Am I going to be fast enough to react and, stop the ball from bouncing in a direction we don't want to go?
It brings up a quote from Alan Watts that I love is, you know, you never know the consequence of good fortune, but you also never know the consequence of misfortune, whether it's going to end up being positive or negative.
Of course. It's a great quote.
There was something, and I think this is in the filming does an unbelievable job. And I think people can relate to it when they've gone to see someone in the hospital and people talk about an eerie feeling in the hospital. But the show follows, I think it was Dr. Langer, and then at other points in the show as well, from behind. And you see, you and your coworkers, they're followed from behind. They're getting changed. They walk out of the hospital. And as soon as those sliding doors open, you can almost feel that breath of fresh air. It's like a different world inside that hospital that you're stepping out of. And I wondered if you can describe subjectively what that world is to you when you enter the hospital every day.
Well, it's game time. You know, it's like walking in down the ramp into the lights of a concert hall, and you're about to perform, or a stadium where you're about to play. It's our cathedral. It's our stadium. It's our court. It's our home field. And I always say, walk into those sliding doors, it's game time. And that's how I approach it.
The way you approach your job, the value that your job has, the purpose, the meaning, you know, and we don't need to dive into that philosophy and psychology because we do enough on this podcast. But does your job feel like a job? And how do you approach it when someone says, you know, what do you do for a living?
So the question is, you know, does my job feel like a job? And the answer is the majority of my job does not feel like a job. The time flies. I'm never, you know, checking the calendar, the clock, and whatnot. It is, you know, constant activity. I'm rarely sitting at a desk. I'm always on the move. I'm running down the stairs, up the stairs, into the operating room, sitting in an operating chair for 6 consecutive hours. But there are bureaucracies, there's paperwork, there's audits and compliance and, you know, crap that we have to do that, you know, brings in the job component of it. And unfortunately, over the time, the bureaucracy of healthcare has increased, and that has brought more of the menial job-like stuff into our field. But at the end of the day, you know, what drives us is the medicine, and that never feels like a job to me.
Obviously, for people listening that would be saying, you know, if I had a job like that, or, you know, if I had a different job, and I think that's one option. If you don't feel that, you know, take the risk to change jobs. But I also think at the same time, we can find that in our work. If we dig deeper than just the rational, I need to do this paperwork and this, it's make it a deeper meaning, a purpose, similar to what you've done. Yeah, no one's, you know, fixing people's brains, but dig for that deep rooted meaning of why you're doing what you do. Let it suck you in that you forget about time. Like you said, I think that's so powerful.
Well, you hit on it, and the word is purpose. Every job has a purpose, and you have to find the purpose. And that's how you avoid burnout and stress. And that has been well studied.
When I was writing this question up, honestly, I was getting chills, you know, down my back and was getting emotional, but it's about the power of connectivity that people have. And we touched on, you know, we've touched on patients, we've touched on your role as a doctor. And I think one thing we forget about is the caregivers and the supporters, the family members. Seeing Chris and Laura in the show, it again, as I talk, I feel the emotion coming over me. I wondered what you've seen in other stories like that. I'm sure in your work, they're not the only couple or family you've seen of that power of connectivity. What is your approach to that? And what if, you know, I guess you've seen the magic and that power in relationships like that with certain patients.
One of the benefits that I have in dealing with brain cancer is that I get to develop relationships with both the patient and their caregivers. And obviously my relationship with Chris and Laura was absolutely, you know, familial. They're family to me. And Laura continues to be essentially part of our team. And we hope to have relationships with families like that, so we can give honest and open and emotional advice, even when the news is bad. That we know what the family's expectations are. Again, we've given that anticipatory guidance. And when the end comes, that everybody is ready for it. However, it doesn't make it any less painful. And we're not shy on the show about showing that we're never ready for the end either. And it's painful for us too when we lose somebody that we love.
With that in mind, and for parents or caregivers listening on to this episode, how has it changed the way you've parented or, you know, had this conversation with others? And obviously you've shared some personal stories already, but does it change the way you raise your family or you interact with your family knowing this?
Oh, I was raised in a very strict household, and my mother will, you know, probably listen to this and agree, but, you know, my parents were very strict. You know, I was not allowed to go out and, you know, party in high school, and I had to read books and not watch TV. The only TV we ever watched was the Met games and Walter Cronkite. And so I grew up in a very strict household. I hate disciplining my kids now. I really am terrible at it. Some of it is because what I do on a daily basis. And understand it, but she thinks I'm a terrible disciplinarian because I don't sweat the small stuff. And, you know, I come home from these tragedies or these losses or these challenges. And I just want my kids to be kids and to enjoy childhood and not worry about the PSATs or, you know, the mean girl in her grade or whatever it is, and just kind of be a child and enjoy it. And I'm not great at disciplining anymore.
Interesting. Well, that's like, and my dad, my mom's the boss, and my dad's more like my brother. So I don't think it's a bad thing if that's the role. The last question, and a couple fun ones to end, but the last one and most important potentially is, what does it, with everything you do, what does a hero mean to you? What does a hero look like?
You know, I don't consider myself a hero. I don't know what a hero really is, but a hero, I think in my mind, you know, I look at, there are different types of heroes, right? You know, Sully, who landed an airplane in the Hudson River, is a hero, right? Jackie Robinson, who obviously broke the barriers of racism in the 50s in baseball, is a hero. You know, everybody has the fundamental qualities to stand up for, let's say, social injustice or other issues that are going on and really capture our hero moment. I think what's great about what's happening in the healthcare profession now is people see that every day we, whether it's a nurse practitioner or a respiratory therapist or an administrator or a doctor, you know, we had to run into a burning building, not literally that was on fire, but with virus that we didn't know whether we can get from, you know, touching our hands or inhaling a droplet. So to me, it's just coming in with the expectation that we're part of a team, that we expect that camaraderie, that understanding, that empathetic approach. And that to me is what being a hero is. A hero is somebody I would want at my side in the trenches, on the ball field, the battlefield, or in the office. That to me is, and that's how I approach, you know, to me, David Langer is my hero, because I know when the shit hits the fan in my life, he's a person that I can go to at work. And the same thing for my wife and my kids.
Wow. Now, The last two questions are a little more fun. And one is, and I told you in the email, my buddies and I have a little bit of a bet on this. You've talked about being an athlete, even through this podcast, but you haven't told us exactly what that sport was. What sport is most likely to lead you to neurosurgery? What was the sport you grew up playing?
I played baseball and soccer growing up. Those were my two sports. And to this day, I'm a hard baseball fan. And unfortunately, I felt the kids are not playing baseball the way we used to play baseball. They're, more and more kids are playing lacrosse, and baseball is boring to a lot of these kids. And so to me, when I watch a baseball game, a squeeze bunt is, off speed pitch, is so exciting. I just eat at every, almost the intellectual capacity game. But I grew up obviously as a soccer player, and as well. So I played soccer, and that was the time, I don't know about you, we were able to play two sports, right? So I played soccer in the fall and baseball in the spring. Now my kids, if you're a great athlete, you really have to play one sport year round, which I think is terrible.
Couldn't agree more. I was soccer and hockey and had to give up one to pursue the other, which I think is more and more people are realizing now that specialize once you're making money or having your school paid for, maybe specialize at that point. But, and last but not least, is there any talk about another season with Lenox Hill?
There is talk. I'm not part of that discussion. That's a discussion that's happening in levels within networking company. So unfortunately I'm not privy to that information, but we'd be happy to do it. We'd love to do it. If they want it. Again, it doesn't really impact what I do on the day to day. It's just a question of whether there's a little microphone here or not.
Amazing. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to add or a message that you wanted to share to conclude, but this has been, again, even more life-changing. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Ben. And, what a great opportunity to just share some insight. And again, one of the benefits of this show is I get to meet people like you and who come with great questions and share great ideas and great experiences. And I think, look, we're all human beings. We're going through a particularly challenging time, and we have to rely on each other as teammates, as classmates, as office mates, as human beings. And I think now is a time that we should rely on the fundamentals that make us happy and great.
That brings us to the end of another Heroic Minds podcast. Again, I encourage you to check out Lenox Hill on Netflix. It really is a life-changing show. As I always say, if you want to keep this conversation going, if you have any recommendations, constructive criticisms, I encourage you to send me an email. My email is always in the description of these episodes. I'm Ben Finelli. This is the Heroic Minds podcast. We'll talk again soon.